is a classic Maine story by King, as Michael Collings explains. This remarkable story of an old woman's life, loves, omissions, and sins showcases King's undeniable storytelling powers, not the least because the entire novel consists of a single, unbroken monologue. There are no chapter divisions, no bits of dialogue from other characters to break Dolores's spell. The entire story is told from a single point of view, through the mouth of Dolores Claiborne, with only momentary pauses as she listens to her questioners, although readers are never allowed to do so, and responds. The result is a work that depends for its overriding success upon an undeviating sense of character, and upon a character interesting enough to repay the reader's investment of time. As he does in Rage, Roadwork, and Misery, King very nearly steps completely out of his horrormeister persona to present a compelling portrait of a believable character. His story is bolstered by underlying wells of anger and frustration, not consumed by it. And his point comes through clearly and directly in the character and speech of Dolores Claiborne, without any obscuring layers of overt agenda or political correctness. 71. Michael Collings on Insomnia, 1994. Insomnia is probably not to every reader's taste. A long novel that threatens an odd kind of stasis in its opening chapters, it has as its hero an old man of 70, recently widowed and increasingly suffering from an unnerving kind of insomnia. It is not that he can't get to sleep, but that he awakens a minute or so early every day until eventually he is living on 2 or 3 hours of sleep, constantly fatigued, almost hoping for death. This is a relatively long process, and King allows the novel to move slowly over the course of months, detailing the consequences of the affliction on Ralph Roberts's life and on his relationship with old friends and neighbors, some of whom simultaneously begin acting strangely, even threateningly. Ralph Roberts discovers that he is not the only one who sees mysteriously energizing auras and little bald men carrying odd implements, or even the only one who can look on someone's aura and abruptly know everything there is to know about that person, including whether he or she, or it in the case of Rosalie the dog, is about to die. With that discovery comes the concomitant discovery that he is not insane, that his insomnia has a larger purpose beyond anything he can truly comprehend, and that he and his newfound love, Lois Chase, have been involved in actions on the cosmic scale approached in It and The Talisman. Confronting one of the little docs who willingly go by the names Ralph suggests for them, Lachesis, Clotho, and Atropos, after the Greek fates that spin, measure, and cut the thread of life, Roberts demands an explanation for their intrusion into human affairs. He gets one. This moment of true apocalypse is as startling as the equivalent revelation of the vampire in Salem's Lot. After almost 300 pages of text, interesting and engaging in its own way, but not as focused as one usually finds in King, Insomnia asserts itself in one short paragraph as a linchpin in King's quest vision, linking itself with The Stand, The Talisman, The Eyes of the Dragon, and the Dark Tower novels as explorations of that mystic nexus of all existence, whose own existence is threatened by a single action about to take place in Derry, Maine. Insomnia is slow-paced at the beginning, but the pace has the stolidity, solemnity, and inevitability of something approaching epic, appropriate to the incremental power of revelation and truth. As King makes connection after connection in the second half of this novel to other works and other worlds, the story takes its place as one of King's most ambitious works, attempting with It, The Talisman, and The Dark Tower series to penetrate the underpinnings of reality itself. and with an adroitness that demonstrates the intensity of his vision. King links the novel's earlier, mundane and therefore transitory, social and political concerns with the heightened sense of a cosmic game between the unseen forces of light and dark, between the purpose and the random. Susan Day's appearance at the Civic Center, as well as the disruption it causes in thousands of lives, also becomes the focus for this episode in the struggle for the Dark Tower and the scene of a key victory for the purpose in the war that may have no end. In his final sacrifice and in its final moments, and Ralph Roberts's, Insomnia attains a dignity, grace, and even grandeur that place death firmly in the pantheon of immutable cosmic forces, along with life, the random, and the purpose. 72. Rose Madder, 1995. In Entertainment Weekly, Mark Harris opined, "When did Stephen King's books stop being so scary?" Citing The Shining, Pet Sematary, and Carrie as novels in which the horror springs from the ease with which evil can take hold of, or masquerade as, decent people. He felt that Rose Madder offered no seductive ambiguity. What does that mean? With an ending that he believed was a cheat. He gives the following reason. She steps through an oil painting of a toga-clad woman warrior into another world, where she has some sort of empowering experience involving a feminist goddess, a maze, a magical stream, and something called the Temple of the Bull. Temple of the Bull, indeed. In the context of a novel that means to explore the psychology of a beaten woman, the random imposition of a supernatural gimmick, especially a wan, fairy-tale-ish conceit that's about as convincing as a CD-ROM game, constitutes a rather stunning cop-out. Or, alternatively, and more significantly, it suggests an ongoing exploration of what it means to be female in our time. Gerald's Game and Dolores Claiborne necessarily precede Rose Madder, which I admit is not what King's horror readers are looking for, the danse macabre. To them, Stephen King, as Clive Barker put it, is the architect of the most popular ghost train rides in the world. As Barker elaborates in an essay in Kingdom of Fear, The World of Stephen King, surviving the ride, King's fiction rockets down the roller coaster tracks by virtue of his charm and accessibility of his prose, the persuasiveness of his characters, the ruthless drive of his narratives. No wonder, then, that when King's horror-hungry fans find themselves staring at a novel like Rose Madder in the bookstore, their appetite for such fare is curbed. The publishers surely recognized this, since they pulled out all the stops, distributing an unprecedented number of advance copies to prime the pump, a reported 15,000 copies, bound in rose-colored paper covers, went out to reviewers. Overtly addressing the theme of domestic violence, which is also at the heart of Dolores Claiborne, the discussion is extended into Rose Madder, which King said is not one of his more successful books, as he told the Paris Review, fall 2006. Every book is different each time you revise it, because when you finish the book, you say to yourself, "This isn't what I meant to write at all." At some point, when you're actually writing the book, you realize that. But if you try to steer it, you're like a pitcher trying to steer a fastball, and you screw everything up. As the science fiction writer Alfred Bester used to say, "The book is the boss. You've got to let the book go where it wants to go, and you just follow along. If it doesn't do that, it's a bad book." And I've had bad books. I think Rose Madder fits in that category, because it never really took off. I felt like I had to force that one. In her review, Laura Wise, Examiner.com, noted that Rose Madder is what might be termed an issues novel, given its focus on domestic violence, pointing out that the novel isn't vampires and aliens horror, but a look at the human monster, Rose's abusive husband, Norman. W. David Atwood, writing for Book of the Month Club's monthly newsletter in 1995, summarized the plot. King went from high school English teacher to one of history's best-selling authors for one simple reason. He dared to confront the 20th century's unspoken fears. The dog in Cujo, the teenage loser in Carrie, the obsessive fan in Misery, the fatal disease in The Stand, the sexual experimentation of Gerald's Game, the crazed dad in The Shining, the sleeplessness of insomnia, all aspects of modern life that scare us, of which we rarely speak openly. Now in Rose Madder, King takes on one of our oldest taboos, one that is very much in today's headlines and, at long last, open for discussion: domestic violence. Rosie Daniels tries hard to be a good wife, but she keeps messing up in little ways, spilling iced tea or getting caught with a racy novel. And when she does, he's always there, every night, to punish her. People around town respect Police Detective Norman Daniels, the handsome, well-built high school sweetheart Rosie married 14 years ago. But they don't know what goes on each night in his own house. The carefully placed punches, the biting that leaves scars, the pencil stabbing, or the shameful thing he did with his tennis racket. Agreeing with Stephen King that Rose Madder does matter, but falls short of its goal, People magazine concluded, "Though this is an engrossing story of a battered woman, its supernatural elements are neither super nor natural." And that's what's the matter with Rose Madder. 73. Clive Barker, Demon Fabulist. Every body is a book of blood. Whenever we're opened, we're read. Clive Barker, epigram in Books of Blood, Scream Press, 1985. As Douglas E. Winter tells the tale, he's in England, visiting Ramsey and Jenny Campbell. Doug tells them that he's currently writing Stephen King, The Art of Darkness. He notes that Ramsey disappeared into the shadows of his writing eyrie, only to emerge with a towering stack of manuscripts, the short stories of an unpublished playwright named Clive Barker. "You're about to read the most important new horror writer of this decade," Ramsey told me. After reading only 50 pages, I was convinced that he was right. In 1984, that towering stack of short stories saw publication by Sphere Books in the United Kingdom. Books of Blood did indeed herald the arrival of a new major talent, one so bright that, as Stephen King, the reigning king of horror, told Time magazine, "You read him with a book in one hand and an airsick bag in the other. That man is not fooling around. He's got a sense of humor, and he's not a dullard. He's better than I am now. He's a lot more energetic." It appeared that the horror heir apparent had arrived, a British invasion, as it were, consisting of a one-man army. The young Brit, who grew up on Penny Lane and whose resemblance to former Beatle Paul McCartney was unmistakable, was heralded and anointed by King, who had been given a copy of Books of Blood and proclaimed, "I have seen the future of horror fiction, and his name is Clive Barker." King paraphrased John Landau, who said, "I saw rock and roll future, and its name is Bruce Springsteen." Emblazoned on the back cover of the U.S. editions of Books of Blood, 1984 and 1985, King's endorsement went a long way toward helping introduce and sell Barker to an American audience out for buckets of blood. The horror fans rejoiced at the appearance of a new dark prince of horror, but it soon became clear that Barker never intended to write only horror fiction. A man of towering creative ambition and a talented visual artist, Clive Barker wrote books that shifted from horror and began to become increasingly complex texts, notably Weave World. As Barker told in The Dark Fantastic, "To be continually engaged, to be continually excited about getting up in the morning, I need to feel like I'm pushing onto new ground. My best hope for another 30 years of creation is to continue to surprise myself. And so it is with Stephen King. In order for him to be excited about getting up in the morning, it means finding the right story and its storytelling mode, and it's not always going to be a tale of supernatural horror. To King, and to any creative person looking to grow, the challenge is in not repeating oneself. The challenge is in finding new worlds to explore, which explains in part the towering edifice known as the Dark Tower with its intersecting worlds. King's desire is that his readers join him for the ride. Sometimes it's a ride into the dark night, on the hell-bound train, with a skeletal figure as the conductor. Sometimes it's immersion in a fantasy world where anything can and does happen. And sometimes it's looking in the mirror and seeing a reflection that doesn't look quite right. Stephen King's canvases are large, and though not all readers will enjoy every picture in his gallery, because many of them only wish to visit his night gallery, he must follow his muse and write the books his way. As King explained in an interview in WB, November/December 1989, "The only thing that matters is the story, not the person who writes it. A writer is not a can of peas. Presumably, if you buy Bird's Eye frozen peas, you're going to get the same block of frozen peas every time you pick one up. But every time you pick up a novel by Stephen King or Tom Clancy or Frederick Forsyth, you are not going to get the same thing. You shouldn't get the same thing. The books shouldn't be standardized to the point where you can say, if I pick this guy up, I know exactly what I'm going to get. If that were the case, why would anybody bother to pick up a particular book? They'd all be the same." Clive Barker on Stephen King. King is not old-fashioned. He is contemporary because he describes a real world. I'd say that old-fashioned horror lacks immediacy. King is a very immediate writer. I aim to be an immediate writer. We want our depictions to appear in the reader's mind with the clarity of a movie. That's part of our modernity. I want my images to be flashing, you know, wham, 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 whereas Poe and Lovecraft created distance between the reader and the image. The experience is safer. You're detached. Murray Cox, Omni Magazine, October 1986. 74. Desperation and the Regulators, 1996. I had been toying with this idea called The Regulators because I had a sticker on my printer that said that. Then one day I pulled up in my driveway after going to the market, and the voice said, "Do The Regulators and do it as a Bachman book and use the characters from Desperation, but let them be who they're going to be in this story." Of course, the first thing I say when the voice speaks up is, "Bachman is dead." But the guy just laughs. Stephen King, Publishers Weekly, 1997. King's dual books of the 1996 book-selling season were launched with considerable fanfare and support. New American Library's Dutton shipped 1.75 million copies in hardback of The Regulators by Richard Bachman, and Viking shipped 1.25 million copies of Desperation. Both bore cover art by Mark Ryden. In fact, if both books are placed side by side, with The Regulators on the left and Desperation on the right, a continuous picture is formed, visually tying them together. Originally, when King approached New America Library about issuing the books simultaneously, the publisher recoiled in horror. "They didn't want to do it," King recalled. Then the publisher wanted to make sure everybody knew The Regulators was also a Stephen King book, so they wanted to publish Bachman's The Regulators with cover credit to King to make the connection clear. But he vetoed that too, because, as he told Bookwire, "You might as well then just say, written by Stephen King." King's common sense viewpoint prevailed. Faced with the challenge of promoting two major books by King at the same time, the hip-joined publishers pulled out all the stops. The $2 million advertising and promotion campaign included a two-for-one pack, in which both books were shrink-wrapped together with a keep-you-up-all-night booklight, limited to 200,000 sets. A floor display unit with a revolving top stocked with a dozen copies. A special toll-free number, 1-888-4-BACHMAN, for recorded information on The Regulators. Abridged audios read by Kathy Bates for Desperation and Mary Louise Parker for The Regulators. 30-second TV ads to push the paired books and linked websites. What the publishers termed the In Your Face, In Your Mind campaign worked as planned. King and Bachman fans knew the books were stacked in bookstores awaiting their arrival. Tempest in a Teapot. King fans were happy to get a free booklight when they bought both novels together, but when they found out subsequent customers got a little paperback with the first two chapters of his forthcoming Dark Tower novel, Wizard and Glass, some of the aggrieved fans complained loudly online. King's response, posted online on November 21, 1996, follows. Gentle readers, it's reached my attention that there's been a fair degree of pissing and moaning about the Wizard and Glass booklet, which comes with a dual purchase of Desperation and The Regulators. I swear to God, some of you guys could die and go to heaven and then complain that you had booked a double occupancy room. And where the hell is the sauna anyway? The major complaints seem to be coming from people who have already bought both books. Those of you who bought the double pack got the light, right? A freebie. So what you crying about? The booklet was my idea, not the publisher's. A little extra for people who wanted to buy both books after supplies of the famous Keep You Up All Night light ran out. If you expected to get the booklet in addition to the light, all I can say is, sorry, Charlie, but there may not be enough booklets to go around. If you bought the two books separately because there weren't any gift packs left, they sold faster than expected, which is how this booklet deal came up in the first place. Go back to where you bought them. Tell the dealer what happened. Show him or her your proof of separate purchase, and they'll take care of you. If they get wise with you, tell them Steve King said that was the deal. If you're just jacked because you want to read the first two chapters of Wizard and Glass, wait until the whole thing comes out. Or put it on your TS, tough shit list, and give it to the chaplain. In any case, those of you who are yelling and stamping your feet, please stop. If you're old enough to read, you're old enough to behave. Desperation by Stephen King. The idea for the novel came to King in 1991. He had flown out to Reed College in Portland, Oregon to retrieve his daughter Naomi's car, and driving on the way back through Ruth, Nevada, he noticed its sparse population and thought, the sheriff killed them all. And thus was born the mining town of Desperation and its deputy named Intragian, who is not what he seems. As King explained to Gilbert Cruz in Time Magazine, 2009, I was raised in a religious household, and I really wanted to give God his due in this book. So often in novels of the supernatural, God is a sort of kryptonite substance, or like holy water to a vampire. You just bring on God, and you say, in his name, and the evil thing disappears. But God as a real force in human lives is a lot more complex than that. And I wanted to say that in Desperation. God doesn't always let the good guys win. I always wanted to say that you can still reconcile the idea that things are not necessarily going to go well without falling back on platitudes like, God has a plan, and this is for the greater good. It's possible to be in pain and still believe that there is some force for good in the universe. That certainly doesn't mean to say that everybody should go out and join the First United Church of My God is Bigger Than Your God. That's half the trouble with the world. Maybe more. The Regulators by Richard Bachman. King's unpublished screenplay, The Shotgunners, written for film director Sam Peckinpah, was the inspiration for The Regulators. as King recalled in Ann Lloyd's Films of Stephen King. It was a strange story of vigilante ghosts from the last century appearing in a western town to avenge a hanging. They came not on horseback, but in three long black Cadillacs with darkened windows. Peckinpah was in pre-production when he died of a heart attack in 1984. In a review of The Regulators, Robert Polito of The New York Times, October 20, 1996, wrote, "The Regulators forsakes even the promise of genre play for generic and interminable tack savagery. It transports the same cast to a mirror image Nevada of the Mind, suburban Wentworth, Ohio, with countless verbal echoes and many role reversals. David Carver is now father to his parents, the whiny Ralph and Ellen. Colley Entragian is a former police officer, not a satanic killing machine, but disgraced, ineffectual, and sad. John Merrinville writes children's books about a feline detective, Pat the Kitty Cat, and characters in this Richard Bachman fiction occasionally talk about reading Stephen King novels." A bulleted book. In what has to be the most imaginative limited edition book ever conceived for a King novel, The Regulators' 52 lettered copies were each placed in an oversized box to make room for its spent bullet casings. Overseen by Peter Schneider and designed by Joe Stefko of Charnel House, the Western motif is carried literally all the way through the book's design, as Peter explained in its press release. "We used a Western theme. The box is basically a wooden tray case, but the book inside is bound in full grain leather with the name, the title of the book, and the author's name branded on the spine. Protruding from the cover are the heads of four Winchester 30, 30 bullets that stick up approximately a half inch. On the back cover, the ends of the fired cartridges protrude. The little pin marks show on the back of each cartridge, since Joe Stefko actually had them fired." 75. The Green Mile. March to August 1996. "It's just an appliance. Its job is not to fry toast or to fry eggs, but to fry human beings' asses." Stephen King on Old Sparky, the electric chair on the movie set of The Green Mile. The Green Mile, Walking the Mile, 2014. Although the practice of releasing works in serial form dates back centuries, serializing novels reached its height of popularity in the 19th century, when writers, including Arthur Conan Doyle and Charles Dickens, published novels in installments to boost magazine sales. The practice, however, continues. Even before the renewed interest in serial publications spawned by the Internet in 1996, Stephen King agreed to serialize a novel published in six installments as mass-market paperbacks. The project was a result of a conversation about serialized fiction between Ralph Vicinanza, the literary agent who handled King's foreign rights, and Vicinanza's friend, the British publisher Malcolm Edwards, who suggested the idea. Vicinanza then approached King with the idea, and King, who is always game for a new way of publishing, wholeheartedly embraced the idea. An intuitive novelist who doesn't outline, his experiment would be a challenge and a matter of faith. Illustrated by Atlanta artist Mark Geyer, the books were originally published as mass-market paperbacks, each priced at $2.99. The publisher cumulatively sold 20 million copies. It was a record year for King, with eight titles on the bestseller list, including the six installments of The Green Mile, Desperation, and The Regulators. No one in book publishing history before or after had ever accomplished that feat. As a result of The Green Mile, the New York Times changed its rules for their bestseller lists so that episodes of a serialized novel counted only as one book. The Genesis. In an introduction that appeared in the trade paperback edition, King confessed that he suffers from cyclical insomnia and thus tries to keep a story handy for those nights when sleep won't come. On one such night, a story came to him. He describes it as a bedtime story called What Tricks Your Eye. It was about a man on death row, a huge black man, who develops an interest in sleight of hand as the date of his execution draws near. At the end of the story, just before his execution, I wanted the huge prisoner, Luke Coffey, to make himself disappear. It was a good idea, but the story wouldn't work for me. I tried it 100 different ways, it seemed, and it still wouldn't work for me. But as time passed, King thought of a way that would work, and Luke Coffey became John Coffey, whose initials are deliberately suggestive. The completed book is one of his finest works, as is the major motion picture based on a screenplay by Frank Darabont, who also directed it. Since King doesn't outline, he, in effect, was driving blind in thick fog. "That is part of the excitement of the whole thing, though," he wrote in an introduction to The Green Mile. To an Entertainment Weekly interviewer, King explained that the serialization process is old-fashioned, the opposite of instant gratification, like pushing a button online and getting something off your laser printer. Not this time. This time you'd have to wait to read the next installment, just like the American readers in 1841 who stood dockside in New York City to get Master Humphrey's Clock serializing The Old Curiosity Shop. In other words, no instant gratification. Better yet, from King's perspective, you wouldn't be able to turn to the last few pages to see how it ended, which he hates. If you are prone to say, "The suspense is killing me," then The Green Mile, stretched out over a period of several months from March to August 1996, was surely a frustrating experience. As King began publishing the individual installments, it became clear that the High Wire Act was going to be a success. As Ralph Vicinanza wrote in an introduction to The Green Mile, the first title in the series, The Two Dead Girls, went on sale at the end of March, and within days we knew it was a hit. It zoomed to the number one position on the New York Times bestseller list. Sales were heavy in all locations. After the six installments were published, they were collected as one novel of 399 pages, along with an introduction and a foreword by King. As King frequently says in interviews, he's not interested in plot. He's interested in characters, and in this novel, we understand why. The characters drive the plot, and not the other way around. The novel is centered on a black man standing 6 feet 8 inches, who dwarfs the prison staff manning death row at Cold Mountain Penitentiary in Georgia. The supporting cast includes Paul Edgecombe, who realizes that there's more to John Coffey than meets the eye, a sadistic guard named Percy Wetmore, who looks down at the world from his short height, a crazed inmate named Wild Bill Wharton, who lives up to his name, and a mouse named Mr. Jingles, who figures largely herein. Burdened by man's woes, by man's inhumanity to his fellow man, their cumulative weight falls squarely on John Coffey's large, broad shoulders, who must bear up under the load, or die trying. John Coffey's numinous presence is a light that shines, even in the darkest of places, a prison's death row in cell block E, where the Green Mile, named after its green-colored linoleum floor, is the end of the road for its inmates. Part 5. Scribner, Building Bridges. 76. The Winter of King's Discontent. The only guy he ever cared about was Tom Clancy. They were both at Penguin once, and it was made clear to King that he was seen as the second banana to Clancy. He didn't like that, but he's very content where he is right now. Scribner. King's literary agent, Chuck Verrill. Rolling Stone, October 2014. Easy Rider. Angus and Robertson Bookstore, Hurstville, Australia. It's closing time, late at night, and the store owner is happy to see the day end without seeing any trouble in his new bookstore. Other retailers in the area have suffered robberies, which have all taken place at closing. So when he sees two men in leather jackets, worn jeans, and ass-kicking boots walk in, his heart skips a beat. One of them stands over 6 feet tall and looks like he could be trouble. A badass. Bad to the bone. The bookseller swallows hard. Looks like it's my turn, he thinks. The taller man puts his large hand in a pocket, and the bookseller gulps. Is he going for a handgun or brass knuckles? But out comes a fistful of dollars. I'd like to see your bestseller list, because I probably have a few books on it, the stranger says. The bookseller, visibly relieved, finds it and hands it over to the man, who studies it carefully. Yeah, I've got a few on here, he says. It's Stephen King, who drove up on his Harley-Davidson motorcycle, which he arranged to have flown in from Bangor. Meanwhile, in New York City. Halfway around the world, Arthur B. Green, King's business manager, who then doubled as literary agent, was hard at work. King was unhappy with New American Library and made no bones about it. The root cause was a recent merger with Putnam, which meant that he was now displaced as King of the Hill. He now occupied the number two position in book sales, clobbered by Tom Clancy, about whom King wrote in the New York Times, November 9, 1998. Clancy sells more copies than I do, and former Penguin Putnam CEO Phyllis Gran is their rabbi. Simple as that. In her defense, in the same story, an anonymous person said that Mr. King was nervous that the publishing house had become Tom Clancy's company, and he had this incredible competition with Clancy. No longer the belle of the ball in his publisher's eyes, King realized that the only thing missing was a bucket of pig blood. King told the New York Post, "Putnam brought in a very potent list. I'm only speculating here, but I think I was just not that important anymore to them. I got the feeling from them, if you want to go, go." Marilyn Duxworth, a publicity flack for New American Library, vehemently disagreed. "We wanted to continue the relationship and did everything in our power to keep him that was economically viable. I'm speculating here, but I think that New American Library tendered its best offer and honestly didn't want to lose him, but that Scribner was adamant about bagging King no matter what it took." In terms of representing King to prospective publishers, Green, an attorney, accountant, and longtime business manager in New York City, handled the deal in an unorthodox manner. King, speaking about Green, told the New York Times that Green had done a great job, but he's not primarily a literary agent. It would not have been handled this way by an agent. As one publisher who had a bone to pick with Green's method explained to the New York Times, a letter was submitted, which seemed very weird, while King was in Australia. "You have a Stephen King, you pick up the phone. You don't write a letter. The publisher meets with the author." The anonymous publisher's comments were echoed by an anonymous literary agent who said, "You call a publisher and say, 'Let's talk.' And by then, you've worked up the numbers. You don't just pull them out of the air. But it's not only about money, it's about editing, publishing philosophy. Which psychology works best?" Green, though, simply sent out letters to prospective publishers and asked for bids, stipulating the size of the next book advance, for Bag of Bones, to be $17 million, the royalty rate 27%, and a reversion clause that effectively leases the books instead of selling them outright in perpetuity for the duration of the copyright. At the Frankfurt Book Fair, the industry's international gathering in October 1997, the talk was about the negotiations as much as it was about Bag of Bones. "I know we did it the wrong way," King told the New York Times in an article by Martin Arnold published a month later. "Hopefully in the end, the talk will be about the book and not about the negotiations." What's the big deal? Scribner, FSG, Farrar, Strauss, and Giraud, Random House, Warner, Morrow, and Atlantic Monthly Grove got Green's package. They all began crunching numbers, knowing what was at stake. Millions of dollars over the long run, and an author who came with a loyal, book-buying fan base. Publishing King, in short, was risk-free publishing if the terms were right. New American Library had a lot to lose. They had a vested interest and had made a big investment in King over the years. Though New American Library gave it their best shot, their effort fell short, and in the end, King made a decision to move to Scribner, whose executives were elated. It would prove to be, as they had hoped, a highly profitable deal. The Scribner deal went well beyond a traditional author-publisher relationship. From what I understand, in exchange for a smaller advance for each book, $2 million a book, King would be partners with the publisher, not simply a client. For King, it was one hell of a good deal. The guarantee of an equitable split meant that King had a stake in the company, just as the company had a stake in him. In other words, it was symbiotic, and not a traditional publisher-author relationship, the kind that hobbled him at Doubleday in his early years. Scribner signed his next three books, including Bag of Bones, which was already complete, a short story collection, Hearts in Atlantis, and a book on writing, On Writing. Years later, in Time magazine, King reflected on what had happened. "I was squeezed out at Viking because Phyllis Grand came from Putnam and she brought with her Tom Clancy, who sold more books than I did. There was a feeling at Viking that they couldn't support two big money writers, and I was the one that went. But the people I still deal with at Scribner were people who were interested in the book rather than the reputation of the writer, which was a penny-dreadful reputation at that point. I give them a lot of credit. To some degree, they rehabilitated my reputation." Bag of Treasures. The company's executives were dancing in the streets, and for good reason. If Bag of Bones was any indication, King was at the top of his game. Susan Muldow, the publisher at Scribner, was quoted in a company news release. "Bag of Bones is the work of a writer at the peak of his powers. It combines a story of a child in jeopardy with familiar elements from King's other works, such as A Haunted House, An Insular and Isolated Community, and Forces No One Can Control. Its story of the numbing effect of grief, the endless manifestations of the creative process, and the emotional richness of an April romance introduce a host of issues and themes of interest to a very broad readership. The book offers an emotional resonance that does not take a back seat to special effects. Bag of Bones is a bag of treasures for a publisher's promotional effort." Gina Centrello, president of Pocketbook, said, "With Bag of Bones, Stephen King has proven he can still delight and surprise readers. It is exciting to launch King's career with Pocket with this novel. King was one of the first writers to experiment with categories and formats, as seen recently in the widely imitated serial publication of The Green Mile, and has a history of making deals with publishers that emphasize growth." Carolyn Ridey, president of the Simon & Schuster Trade Division, said, "From the appearance of Carrie in 1974, Stephen King has demonstrated not just an ability to capture an audience of unprecedented size with more than 225 million copies of 38 books in print, but has always demonstrated a unique sensitivity to the dynamics of the publishing industry. His career has been marked by experimentation and collaboration with his various publishers." And Simon & Schuster's consumer group president, Jack Romano, said, "Stephen King has proven to be as creative with his deal-making as his writing. Our partnership is based on the value of the works. The actual performance of each title will determine the profit participation. The deal structure puts priority on growing the Stephen King readership to even greater levels." As for the author himself, King concluded, "I'm happy that the search for a new publisher has ended so successfully. Bag of Bones contains everything I now know about marriage, lust, and ghosts, and it was essential to me that I find the right partner to publish it. It was a smart move for both King and Scribner, and this third time may prove to be the charm. It's a relationship that's lasted 17 years, and that shows every sign of continuing for the foreseeable future. 77. Michael Collings on Bag of Bones, 1998. Bag of Bones was one of the strongest tales Stephen King had published in some time. Eschewing overt social criticism while simultaneously examining a number of such social issues as integral parts of the story, this new novel harkened back to the Stephen King who wrote such memorable novels as The Shining and It, yet it also suggested that he was looking forward to new possibilities. That initial compliment delivered, it needs to also be noted that in some important ways, Bag of Bones resembles earlier successes perhaps only too strongly. The tone at times seems derivative of King at his best. As occurred in The Shining, It, The Dark Half, and elsewhere, this story focuses on the problems of a best-selling novelist confronting writer's block. Now, while writer's problems might certainly present persistent threats for a writer of King's stature, although no one has even suggested that he himself has suffered from writer's block, if anything, he is criticized more frequently for the opposite issue. Their recurrence in novel after novel, story after story, makes it increasingly difficult for readers to empathize with the characters, especially as in this case, when the writer in question, Michael Noonan, is worth over $5 million. King does seem aware of the implicit complications involved in writing novels about novels, since he takes pains to shift his narrator-writer's chosen genre from horror to quasi-erotic romance, and then pits him against an antagonist whose half-billion fortune makes Noonan's $5 million seem paltry. But still, readers may have difficulty squaring precisely with the travails of a man with an abundance of ready cash, two homes, and seemingly much going for him. At heart, then, Bag of Bones is about humanity, about the bag of flesh and bones that encompasses each of us and links us with past and future. It is a generational story in several senses. Noonan's ability to generate, whether it be novels or children, remains much in doubt. William DeVore, on the other hand, has generated too much wealth, too much power, too much greed and ambition, and, ironically, too many children. One of his sons is gay and will never generate children. Another is dead, and yet has given life to Key. Not content with exploring his role as grandparent, DeVore wants to possess, metaphorically devour, Key, and we discover eventually there are several senses in which his compulsion to devour ceases being purely metaphorical. Other local families face similar problems in generating lasting progeny, and we are reminded again and again of the childless adults of It, and of that novel's close identification of adult responsibility with adult generation. But it would not be surprising if Bag of Bones pointed to a shift in direction for King, as it does for his fictional author. The monsters, both human and supernatural, are sublimated to story, and in this way, King asserts triumphantly that whatever monsters may lie in the past, whatever loss and grief and death and sorrow colors the past, the future lies in human ties, human relationships, and human love. 78. Storm of the Century, an original screenplay, 1999. Some folks in New England still shudder when they recall major storms of two different centuries, one in 1978 and another in 2011. I remember the 1978 storm. I was working in the Boston area and saw the city paralyzed when the then governor, Michael Dukakis, shut down traffic coming in and out of the city. Out in the burbs where I lived, a goodly number of people who couldn't get around by car because the roads were unplowed and impassable took to their skis. I, on the other hand, was housebound, a transplanted Virginian. I couldn't ski. The storm in 1978 was a classic nor'easter. It moved up the coast, it stalled in the waters over Nantucket, and it didn't go anywhere, recalled meteorologist Dr. Mel Goldstein of WTNH-TV in the New Haven Register. The mother of all storms, though, was the blizzard of 1888, when a record 50 inches of snow fell. History repeated itself in 2011, when a storm dumped 30 inches of snow the first day and over 3 days 50 inches total. As Goldstein remarked, I was so amazed that, yes, I was living through a period of time that was duplicating the blizzard of 1888. There's nothing like a major meteorological event to make everything in life grind to a complete halt, as depicted in the made-for-TV movie Storm of the Century, air date February 14th to 18th, 1999, based on King's screenplay of the same title, which was published in book form with his introduction. Trapped. Stephen King has frequently used the device of being trapped in place for several novels and short stories. A town, Under the Dome. A supermarket, The Mist. A hotel, The Shining. A car, Cujo. A bedroom, Gerald's Game, Misery. An interrogation room, In the Death Room. Even a toilet stall and a porta-potty. No shit. In Storm of the Century, the location of entrapment is once again a town. But this time, the entrapper is a snowstorm. Not a massive dome that descends on the hapless townsfolk. King's screenplay is a contemporary revisiting of a time-honored literary device, The Stranger Who Comes to Town, which recalls Richard Straker and his master, a vampire named Kurt Barlow in Salem's Lot, and Leyland Gaunt in Needful Things. As King writes in the introduction to the screenplay, published in book form, André Linoge in Storm is an extremely evil man. Maybe not a man at all. An entity so terrifying that Mike Anderson's wife has no compunctions about asking her husband, the constable on Little Tall Island, to ensure André Linoge has an accident. In other words, she's asking her husband to kill Linoge for the good of the community. She feels murder, in this case, is justified. And she's right. What makes Storm of the Century unique among King's publications is that it is a screenplay, though it could just as easily have been written as a novel. The $33 million production, which began shooting in late February 1998 and ended 80 days later, airing on ABC, is quintessential King. It exposes the dark heart of an insular community isolated from the mainland and left to its own devices. What's at stake? Whether the townsfolk will unanimously agree to Linoge's unthinkable demand. Give me what I want, Linoge says, and I'll go away. But it's too high a price to pay. As Mike Anderson, the town constable, tells us on the first page of the screenplay, I know one thing. In this world, you have to pay as you go. Usually a lot. Sometimes all you have. That's a lesson I thought I learned 9 years ago, during what folks in these parts call the storm of the century. He should know. The raging storm mirrors the internal angst, indecision, and roiling turmoil that churns within each member of the community. They are forced by Linoge to literally choose between the devil and the deep blue sea. In his introduction, King takes a neutral stance on whether a screenplay trumps a novel. I won't argue, either pro or con, that a novel for television is the equal of a novel in a book. I will just say that once you subtract the distractions, ads, I myself think that is possible. Perhaps. But I think most people will pass over reading the screenplay and pop the DVD in their player, turn the lights low, snuggle up to their honey bunny on the couch, and munch on popcorn while viewing it. King explains that, like The Green Mile, Storm of the Century also started with a jailhouse image. He elaborates. That of a man, white, not black, sitting on the bunk in his cell, heels drawn up, arms resting on knees, eyes unblinking. This was not a gentle man, or a good man, as John Coffey in The Green Mile turned out to be. This was an extremely evil man. Maybe not a man at all. I find it easy enough to read screenplays, and I think you will too. The Pocketbooks edition, published in 1999, I'm happy to say, provides screenshots from the TV movie, so you'll get a visual sense of the movie itself. I'm confident in saying that once you start reading the screenplay or watching the TV movie, you won't want to stop. Because, as Kathy Bates so eloquently explained when she introduced King at a public reading in New York City, Stephen King's got the gift of gotta. Gotta read. Gotta keep reading. Gotta finish. Gotta. And on that note, I gotta go to my well-worn copy of Storm of the Century, because I want to again read about the mysterious stranger who is wicked bad and comes unbidden to an unsuspecting town to claim what is not his own. As a result, we are properly horrified. On Storm of the Century. This series also makes it clear that Steve knows a lot more about Maine than the people who put together the TV show Murder, She Wrote. Storm of the Century doesn't offer much aid and comfort to the people who want to promulgate a sentimental vision of quaint, old Down East folks. For, like most Maine natives, Steve feels a good deal of ambivalence about his state. He loves and hates it. And sometimes the love feels like hate. Or is it plain old fear? Surrounded by all that gorgeous but inhuman nature, we can never forget how fragile are the communities that we create, and this sense of vulnerability creates a certain claustrophobia. You mean I'm going to live out the rest of my life with these people? At some point, these words go through the mind of every one of us, and it is this peculiar combination of dependence and paranoia that defines the main character. So, too, what makes Steve King a Maine writer is his persistent, even obsessive exploration of this claustrophobic territory. Burton Hatlin, from joshuamaine.com, no longer accessible. 79. The Girl Who Loved Tom Gordon, 1999. The woods themselves are real. If you should visit them on your vacation, bring a compass, bring good maps, and try to stay on the path. Stephen King, author's postscript, The Girl Who Loved Tom Gordon. The Girl Who Loved Tom Gordon, King wrote in a letter to book reviewers that accompanied Galleys, was Grimm's Hansel and Gretel without Hansel. In Grimm's grim tale, it's Gretel who saves the day. And in King's short 219-page novel, it's Tricia McFarland who saves herself. She's on her own, and her Hansel, as it were, is Tom Gordon. A 9-year-old girl wandering in the great and terrible wilderness for 9 days and 8 nights, Tricia is far from home and faces possible death. The world has teeth, and it could bite you with them any time it wanted, King writes in the first chapter, pregame, and indeed, Trisha's world is filled with predators, with something stalking her. And it has teeth. What helps sustain Tricia through her ordeal is an imagined Tom Gordon, who, of course, in real life, was a Major League Baseball pitcher for the Red Sox from 1996 to 1999. Listening to the Red Sox games on her Sony Walkman sustains her, and in her fevered imaginings, Tom Gordon appears to come alive. Distracted, perhaps, by the werewolves and the vampires, the monsters within and without, readers may not necessarily notice a running thread that binds all King's fiction together, an ongoing exploration and examination of God. Raised in the Methodist faith, Stephen King, walked away, as the saying goes, at an early age. Life is a mystery, as King postulates in this novel. And God is even more of a mystery, the ultimate one, because it requires faith. And without faith, we too, like Tricia McFarland, are lost in the wilderness. But this is a story, and like the revised version of the Hansel and Gretel story, this one also ends well. I don't think anyone would be surprised by that revelation. But as King continues to ponder the nature of existence, in this world and in whatever world beyond when one crosses over, his vision has gotten darker. King's revival, for example, is not so much an exploration of God, but of his absence. Novelists write books as a form of internal dialogue, to think aloud, to make sense of the world, and to grapple with the mysterious on a regular basis. In the end, The Girl Who Loved Tom Gordon is an optimistic tale. There's room in the Stephen King universe for stories about the ghosts and the ghoulies and the werewolves and the vampires, just as there's room for courageous little girls, the Gretels of the world, who rise to the occasion and find solace by discovering the strength in themselves to persevere and overcome obstacles, no matter how seemingly insurmountable. Christopher Lehman Haupt, New York Times, April 15, 1999, wrote, "Reading the novel produces several satisfying moments of feverish terror where you can picture Trisha's bones bleaching in a sunlit landscape, utterly indifferent to her being. As the narrator puts it, the world had teeth, and it could bite you with them any time it wanted." She knew that now. She was only 9, but she knew it, and she thought she could accept it. Thanks to King's gruesome imagination, you as a reader feel the sharpness of those teeth. 80. The Day That Changed King's Life. The Accident. June 19, 1999. The imaginative person has a clearer fix on the fact of his/her fragility. The imaginative person realizes that anything can go disastrously wrong at any time. Stephen King. A forenote to the 2010 edition, Danse Macabre. The phone call came in late in the evening from Stephen Spignesi, a good friend and pop culture writer. "Did you hear Stephen King just died?" he asked. I thought he was kidding, but he was not. Further conversation revealed that cyberspace was abuzz with speculation about Stephen King's current condition, after the media reported that he had been hit by a careless driver in Maine near his summer home. As is always the case with breaking news, the rush to report supersedes accuracy. The fact was that King had been involved in an accident in which he was seriously injured. He was struck by a van driven by Brian Smith, or Mr. B.S., whose driving record was blemished. Put differently, he should have had his driving license revoked years before, because he was an accident waiting to happen. But the courts in Maine saw differently and continued to let him drive, even after the evidence suggested he was a danger. His list of moving violations incontestably proved that the state of Maine is reluctant to pull licenses from their drivers, no matter how justified. Smith had gone out on the road because he wanted to go to the store and get a Mars bar. Smith was driving on the highway near Center Lovell, where the Kings maintain a summer home, and Stephen King was walking on the shoulder of the road when he saw Smith's minivan come over the hill, rapidly bearing down on him at 45 miles per hour. Because King has brilliantly told his harrowing tale, a real-life horror story, in On Living, a Postscript, I won't repeat what he said. Instead, you should read it for yourself. But what's important here is that he realized it was a turning point in his life. Depending on what happened afterward, it would either be very bad or passably good. He could die, or he would survive after rounds of operations and physical therapy. It was a throw of the dice. "I don't want to die," he wrote in his essay. and as I lie in the helicopter looking out at the bright summer sky, I realize that I am actually lying in death's doorway. Someone is going to pull me one way or the other pretty soon. It's mostly out of my hands. In point of fact, it was entirely out of his hands. King survived his harrowing near-death experience, and like others who have had similar experiences, he came away with four immutable truths. First, life is fragile. Second, every new day is a gift and a new lease on life. Third, it's later than you think, so it's time to get your life in high gear and get what you want done. And fourth, you cherish the people in your life because they are your nearest and dearest, and everything else is a distant second. By the grace of God, if you believe in him, and King, like most Americans, wants to believe, King miraculously recovered. And in the years since, King has completed numerous books, including the Dark Tower series, putting an end to questions about when he'd ever complete it. His other fiction, too, reflected the growing concerns of his inevitable aging. In a career known, indeed celebrated, for fear, that old boogeyman has never left the building. What changed was only the nature of fear. Back when he was a new dad and a recent college graduate, his fears concerned not being able to provide for his family and his children getting injured. Now, King is a wealthy man, and his kids are adults